Workshop is fresh expressions in the sacramental tradition, and as I look out to this group here, there are some people I know and many who I don't know, but I see parish priests, I see committed lay people, I see at least one deacon that I can identify. I see people, at least from the Diocese of Toronto, who serve and attend in a variety of kinds of parishes, including what we would call Anglo-Catholic parishes, but not exclusively. So there's considerable diversity sitting here in this room. And we have about an hour and 10 minutes for this workshop, and I will introduce you in a minute and then invite you to offer some reflections and comments, and then I hope through the rest of the workshop we can see a conversation, questions, and comments going back and forth. So is that accord with your understanding?
Yeah, that sounds good.
Okay. I'll just say a couple of words of introduction about Bishop Stephen Cottrell, who has been the Bishop of Chelmsford since October 2010, so you're still within the first year of that. And I believe that your translation to that diocese foiled our plans to have you here in person last September, but I hope that that may happen again in the not-so-distant future. Before that, Bishop Cottrell was the Bishop of Reading, which is a suffragan bishopric in the Diocese of Oxford, consecrated in 2004 at the age of 45. So there you go. Studied at St. Stephen's House, Oxford, was a parish priest, diocesan missioner for the Diocese of Wakefield, and then canon pastor of Peterborough Cathedral before his ordination to the episcopate. I think perhaps the best way to say something about Bishop Cottrell's breadth of interests and expertise is simply to give people here a taste of the titles of the books that you have authored, because I think this says a great deal about your range. So here goes. There's about eight or nine titles here. Hit the Ground Kneeling, Seeing Leadership Differently. A book, this next book I have read and I need to read again. Do Nothing to Change Your Life, Discovering What Happens When You Stop. Abundance of the Heart, Catholic Evangelism for All Christians. I Thirst, the Cross, the Great Triumph of Love. Praying Through Life, How to Pray in the Home, at Work, and in the Family. On This Rock, Bible Foundation for Christian Living. Sacrament, Wholeness, and Evangelism, A Catholic Approach. And Catholic Evangelism. So I would ask folks here to welcome Bishop Cottrell. So with that, Bishop, I wonder if I could to ask you to launch us into this conversation.
Great, thank you very much. It's really good to be with you through Skype. I would much prefer to be with you in person. And despite the concerns I have over my carbon footprint, I have been one of those people who have always considered an invitation which involves a flight to North America to be the direct and revealed will of God. I've always enjoyed. I've only been to Canada once, but so enjoyed that trip a few years ago. So I hope maybe to come to the diocese at some point. I thought I'd just start by telling you a couple of stories, and I hope the stories may lead into some conversation that we can have. A lot of my ministry has been involved with trying to develop authentic and appropriate Catholic models of evangelization for churches, chiefly in England, but also I've done some teaching and leading of mission, particularly in Australia and in Canada and the United States. So here's a story from a mission that I was leading, a very traditional sort of parish mission in a very poor parish in a town called Middlesbrough in the northeast of England. And I took with me a team of seminarians, at least two religious, I mean, one Franciscan friar, one sister, I can't remember the order she came from. So there's a team of us on this mission. And the mission involved a lot of visiting around the parish, various events in people's homes, services in the evenings. It was a traditional parish mission. And most evenings, when the evening event finished, we went to the pub over the road from the church, where we were made very, very welcome. And one of the highlights of the evening in the pub was they had a karaoke machine, which was very popular with all the locals who went to drink there. And as the days of the mission went by, and as we were going into this pub every night, and as we kind of made a sort of bit of a fancy dress parade with various priests and religious trooping into this pub, so we were persuaded to have a go on the karaoke machine, and one by one we'd get up to sing a song. Anyway, the Saturday evening was the final evening of the mission, and we'd been told by the locals we'd befriended in the pub that this was the big karaoke night and we had to be there, as we'd sort of become kind of minor celebrities. So after the mission service finished and after the bum fight in the parish finished at about 10:30 at night, we troop over to this pub, which during the week had not had many people in it, is now absolutely packed out. And we were also kind of ushered to the front to sing songs on the karaoke. Well, I took my turn. I can't quite remember what song I sung. It was probably the songs you know how to sing date you perfectly, don't they? So they were probably from the 70s. It was either Great Anglo-Catholic Classic, Gloria Gaynor's I Will Survive is probably what I sang, or it might have been something by ABBA. Anyway, I get up to sing on the karaoke machine, and there's a couple of hundred people in the pub. When I finished singing, it was obviously a very moving performance, when I'd finished singing, the sort of DJ guy who runs it, who I've got to know during the week, he's got his microphone in one hand. I've still got the microphone in my hand. And he says to me, across the crowded pub, he says to me, "Why do you sing songs that nobody knows?" Now, at first, I misunderstood what he meant. And I started saying, well, you know, I'm singing songs from the 70s because that's kind of my era. They're the pop songs I know the best. And he goes, no, I don't mean on the karaoke. I mean in church. Why do you sing songs that nobody knows? And as I tell you this story, I mean, bear in mind, there are a couple of hundred people eavesdropping on this conversation. And I didn't know how to answer him. Why do we sing songs that nobody knows? And this kind of conversation across the crowded pub brought home to me that the great gulf there is between the culture of the world in which we are set and the very distinctive culture of the church, particularly those of us who are happy to describe and define our Christianity from within a Catholic and sacramental tradition. We are singing songs that nobody knows. I was happy at this point that the microphone got put down and we continued the conversation over a drink without the whole of the pub eavesdropping on us. And I don't have any great conclusions to offer you other than it brought home to me the great need for us to find some new tunes, which is, I mean, the image I have is that we need to reclothe not just the way that we worship and the way that we do things, but the whole way that we speak about the gospel. Can we find a way of clothing it, which is at one and the same time continuous with the tradition of which we are a part, yet is breathing fresh life into that tradition? So I kind of felt this guy was sitting in judgment on the fact that in so many parts of the church, we've simply stopped moving and growing and discerning what are the new cultural clothes within which we may want to try to dress the worship and the faith that we share. So we may have some conversation about that. What are the new songs we need to learn? And I think the real challenge of that question is at one level, it is about, you know, you could say, well, the words stay the same. We just need to set them to some new tunes. What are the new cultural clothes the gospel needs to put on? But of course, I guess most of us are aware that actually the culture poses questions which ask us, what is the gospel itself? How might the gospel itself be responding to the refining fire of the questions our culture asks us? So that's one thing which just poses a question. Second story, which is not an answer, but maybe is the beginning of an answer. I was a parish priest in a place called Chichester in England. Chichester is right on the south coast. And it was a council estate parish. By council estate means poor housing on the whole. Chichester's quite a wealthy place, but it has this council estate. And on English council estates, quite often young people, and this must happen the world over, young people without much to do in life, without much to hope for, tend to kind of congregate in public places like a church and kind of do things that young people do the world over. And in this church in Chichester, where I was the incumbent, if we had a midweek mass, quite often some of the young people who were congregating in the porch would run into the church, I don't know, shout some abuse, make a bit of noise, and then run out again. And it was just a bit of a game they played, and none of us really bothered about it too much. It was all part of the life of that place. However, on Sunday evenings, we had a service of benediction. And the reason we started having this service of benediction was not for any great mission strategy. We had it because I rather like benediction, and I thought it might be quite a good thing to do, and might also be a nice counterpoint to the wordiness of so much of the rest of our liturgy and worship. And because I didn't want to make a big deal of it, I pared down the liturgy so that it was very, very easy to maintain and to put on, and didn't need a great team of servers, didn't even need musicians. We could just come along and do it. And so the service consisted of, this was quite a small, modern, flexible building, which was very helpful. I used to go over to the church at about 5 o'clock in the evening. I used to clear back some of the chairs. That would only take me about 5 minutes to create a big open space around the altar. I would light lots of candles. I would play some recorded music, you know, kind of, you know, religious mood music just playing in the background, burn some incense, put the sacrament on the altar and sit down. And basically the service consisted of half an hour, 40 minutes of almost total silence, only broken by maybe a very short reading, some very short petitionary prayers, maybe one simple song, which was more of a chant than a song, so you didn't need any books or any bits of paper. And I found not only did this become a very, you know, it was a service that grew and grew, more and more people came and were drawn to this worship, which was contemplative silence, the point of the story. It was the one service that the young people who hung around outside the church, it was the one service they came to. And those same youngsters who at other services used to come in and cause a bit of disruption and run off, they were kind of magnetically drawn to the stillness, the silence, the contemplation of this very strange and particular act of worship. And what that made me realise is that part of the kind of liturgical reworking that needs to go on, which the whole Fresh Expressions movement is now giving us impetus to, is to find ways of re-inhabiting our tradition. For those of us who are shaped by Catholic spirituality and Catholic theology, this will mean particularly inhabiting our sacramental traditions, and finding ways that they may connect and speak, as it were, in a new song, a new song to the Lord, which will connect with people who hitherto have actually found the worship and liturgy of the church an alienating experience. And perhaps finally for me for the moment, because I'd much rather open it up and listen to some questions that you have, what is fascinating about Fresh Expressions in the United Kingdom at the moment is that a movement which, I think if we're honest, we'd have to say began with a lot of energy, particularly from charismatic evangelicals, many of whom were a bit disillusioned with a lot of evangelical worship and indeed doctrine, is now gaining quite a lot of momentum from churches from a Catholic and sacramental tradition. And what I see uniting all those churches is quite a bold reimagining of the liturgical tradition, where liturgy is now much more contemplative and yet at the same time much more participative. Sometimes the participation is through silence and contemplation, But sometimes the participation is through the active engagement and involvement in the worship. And my experience by accident in Chichester was just one small example of that. Can you still hear me and see me?
Yes, absolutely, both.
Oh, that's good, because my little pop-ups have appeared on my screen. It may just be the computer's way of saying, shut up now and let them get a word in. So I'll stop at that point. There's quite a few other stories I could tell you about the way I've seen different churches engage with a kind of emergent way of worshipping and inhabiting the liturgy. But because I'm not at your conference, I don't quite know what you've been talking about, you know, yesterday and earlier today. So I think I'd much rather hear from some of you and see if I can respond to some of your observations or questions.
Well, thank you very much for both of those stories, and please do hold those other ones in reserve. We'll take the temperature of the room and see what our proportion of introverts to extroverts is, and if we're more introverts than extroverts, we may need to hear more of your stories, and I hope we will, because I think one of the struggles that those of us who would identify ourselves as in the Catholic tradition or Catholic-minded, one of the struggles I think we are having in this diocese, and I can speak personally in terms of my own parish situation, is imagining what a fresh expression in that tradition might look like. So, well, thank you very much for those opening stories. I'm not sure at what point we got cut off, but I was saying that I think it's very helpful for us here to hear those very tangible and practical examples. So I hope that we'll hear more of those as this conversation continues. I'm going to invite people here to offer comments and ask questions, and I will launch that part by a thought or a question of my own. What you say about the trajectory of fresh expressions and those in the Catholic tradition sort of needing to catch up is certainly true in this part of the world. One of the emphases that we hear a lot about is that we need to get outside our church buildings. And our keynote speaker this morning talked about a wonderful T-shirt which said, "The church has left the building. The church has left the building." And I think it's one of the challenges for Catholic-minded Christians to imagine what liturgy looks like when it's not inside our cherished buildings. And I hope that's not just about worshiping our buildings, but there's something fundamental about the juxtaposition, if I can put it that way, of buildings and liturgy. I wonder if you would care to comment on the question of in the building, outside the building, either or, both and.
Yeah, well, I don't think you can separate out the work of fresh expressions and that kind of liturgical reimagining which is associated with it from the general ongoing work of the mission of God's church. So, you know, we are called to be a missionary church. By mission, what I understand is participating in the mission of God. So the first question that any Christian community needs to ask itself is, how is my church, meaning, you know, the people, you know, this community of faith, how is this community of faith of which I am a part, how is it a blessing to the community in which we are set? That just seems to me to be a fundamental question that every community needs to ask. Are we experienced as a blessing to this community? And if we're not, how might we be a blessing? I mean, that's a good question to ask ourselves as individuals. How is my life a blessing to the people I meet each day, to my colleagues at work, to my family, to my neighbours? And that's the first thing, is how are we a blessing? Now, if we are a blessing, to the life of our community, then that would be provocative. It will provoke questions and interests and intrigue. What is this about? So that's the first thing. I mean, I know that's not the subject of this seminar or your conference, but you cannot not talk about the general participation in the mission of God and then the specific work of evangelization. How are we, through our ministry and life, commending the gospel of Jesus Christ to others? Now, at that point, I think those of us who were shaped by a Catholic theology and spirituality need to go on to say that as we invite people to know Christ and to become members of his church, And that, of course, is, I mean, the most important insight or rediscovery of recent years is that for most people, becoming a Christian is like a journey. Therefore, the work of evangelism is best understood as helping people make the journey. The distinctiveness of the Catholic insight is as we invite people to make that journey into Christ, it also means being part of his church. And to be part of his church must mean participating in the sacramental life. For us, the sacramental life is not some exotic extra that certain people like. It is of the essence of the life we have in Christ here on earth. So we must be a baptizing community. We must be a Eucharistic community. And we believe that also about the whole church. So I don't quite get the in the building or out of the building stuff. Of course, we are a church that should be serving our community and seeking to bless it. Of course, we should have programs, though I hope there'll be a huge variety of them, which invite people to make the journey into faith. But once you start making that journey into faith, then you must also be inviting people to participate in the sacramental life. And what I think the Fresh Expressions within the Catholic tradition is encouraging us to do is to look at the way we give expression to the sacramental life, which is enabling more people to participate in it more fully. And where the debate is going on in England is very much to do with some people within the Catholic tradition of the Church of England rather resistant to that reimagining of our own tradition. Should I keep going? Give just one small example of that. I mean, I don't know whether you have this in Canada, but in England, we have most of our churches have an 8 o'clock Eucharist on a Sunday morning, as well as the main Sunday morning celebration. So what that means is that virtually every one of our churches has two Eucharistic communities on a Sunday morning. One at 8 o'clock, which is usually a small said service, often using the Book of Common Prayer, and then a main Sunday celebration using a contemporary language liturgy. Two distinct worshiping communities in the same building who hardly ever meet each other. That is a fact of the life of the Church of England. What I think the Fresh Expressions movement has encouraged us to think about is, if it is okay to have two distinct Eucharistic communities in the one building on the one Sunday morning, why shouldn't you have three? Or why shouldn't you have four? And actually, the growing and developing of a third or fourth sacramental community might actually be the means whereby you enable different people to come and engage more fully with the life of the church. The objection to this often comes from people saying, you know, we must be the one people of God around the one altar at the one time. And whenever I hear priests say this, I tell them that I'm not really prepared to listen. I mean, I say it with a smile. I say, I'm not really prepared to listen to this line of reasoning any further until they have the courage to cancel their 8 o'clock service. Because as soon as you have an 8 o'clock service, you've crossed a theological Rubicon. Which says that it is okay for there to be more than one Eucharistic community. So I think what I'm saying here is some of the objections within the Church of England are important theological objections about what they see as a kind of niche marketing multiplicity of services. However, without realising it, we've been doing that for centuries, and it may present us with an interesting way forward because, and I will shut up at this point to let somebody else ask something, because the other thing that we as Catholics believe, which again is my slight worry about the building out of the building thing, is we believe in the evangelizing and converting power of worship. So for us, worship isn't simply the end point of the journey. We also believe that worship itself has the power to convert, and actually inviting people to, though that is hard, but giving people an opportunity to experience the sacramental life of the church could actually be the first step on the journey, not necessarily always the last.
Thank you for that. Ryan has trained the camera on the participants, so I'm now going to grab one of the microphones, which I think is this one, Ryan? Is it this one here?
Thank you very much. There's a lot happening in those areas. And it's very interesting to observe what I think the Spirit might be saying to the church at the moment in this area. In England, we have a lot of traditional religious communities. Sadly, most of them are in serious decline and probably are going to die. There will be a few exceptions, but that seems to be what's happening. And yet at the same time, as there's a great crisis and malaise within traditional religious life, there is a massive flourishing of the religious life in all kinds of unexpected ways. Now, a lot of it is not coming directly from within the Catholic tradition. Some of it is coming, in England at any rate, from charismatic evangelicals who getting rather disillusioned with some evangelical worship are now beginning to explore very, very purposefully Catholic spirituality. And there are a lot of small communities of faith in England that would now describe themselves, and this is their own language about themselves, as a kind of new monasticism. And these are often younger Christians. It's not really a fresh expression of church in the sense it's not a fresh expression of Sunday morning church. It's much more a fresh expression of the religious life. And I wonder whether that might be the most distinctive contribution that the Catholic tradition is making to the Fresh Expressions movement worldwide, that it was, a lot of it did grow out of a kind of the latest version of a kind of church planting, church growth mentality. But what's now happening alongside it, it is a growth in the religious life, which obviously is not just about the contemplative prayer, though that is very much a part of it. It is also about a fresh expression of community, a fresh expression of rule of life, a fresh expression of obedience. And so there's lots of things that are happening like that. They're all, in my experience, small and fragile and very provisional. But at the heart of it is a desire to live the Christian life differently and to find ways of worshipping and living together which express that differently. And I suspect, dare I make this point? This is a little hobby horse of mine. I'll just ride it once round your room quickly, then I promise to get off. I mean, it occurs to me that in Europe was not evangelized by vicars. Europe was evangelized by monks and nuns. That's a big generalization, but that's basically true. The great evangelization of Europe was done by religious. I think that if there is going to be a re-evangelization in Europe, it will probably also come not from vicars, it'll come from religious. And so I'm wondering whether what the Fresh Expressions movement will really give birth to is a new monasticism, a new way of living in community. And it might be that new way of living in community will actually have the most evangelizing impact on our culture. At the moment, all I see is lots of fragile but very beautiful little plants beginning to grow all over the place. And they don't look like the kind of charismatic knees up of so many evangelical churches, but they don't look like high mass in the Anglo-Catholic churches either. They look like St. Francis and a few friars, you know, taking to the road and living under a rule of life. That's what they look like. I mean, I think this is where the Fresh Expressions agenda can actually be liberating, because I think once you've crossed the theological Rubicon, and I think all of us do have to cross that and recognise, because I think all of us have been shaped by the Catholic tradition, we have it in our minds that what we ought to be doing is, as I said earlier, the one people of God gathered around the one table of the Lord at the one celebration of the Eucharist on a Sunday. And that's a wonderful theological vision. But I believe God may be asking us to not lay that vision down, but give it fresh expression. And the fresh expression of that vision, which can be liberating for us, is to say, actually, the missional needs require us to express our worship differently. And actually trying to express that worship differently within the constraints of the community we've inherited will probably kill us and we'll fail anyway. Therefore, we can start again. So if I could, I don't like using military metaphors, but if I could use one just once, the bad general fights his battle on two fronts. And I think paradoxically, that's what God is asking us to do at the moment, which is tough if you're a parish priest. But I think at one and the same time, and this is what I'm saying to a lot of the clergy I serve, is I'm saying at one and the same time, we have to nurture and love that which we have inherited, but at the same time, we need to start something new, a new expression of church within that one community. Now, that doesn't mean to say the theological vision of being the one people of God doesn't matter anymore, but we also have to find a new way of expressing that. So if one thinks of having two or three distinct worshipping communities within the one parish, if you think of those as cells of the body, those cells do need from time to time to come together. And that's an additional challenge. I don't think we can let ourselves off the hook. But I would say to you, and I mean, I know it's easy to say this, I've got no idea what constraints you're working under, but I would say to you, is there a way of starting again, even if it's with only a handful of people? But is there a way of being church with those few people which will be life-giving and energising for you and may indeed be the seedbed of future growth and flourishing? One last thing on this, which encourages me, is in my reading of the Gospels in recent years, one thing that keeps on striking me is the disproportionate amount of time Jesus gives to a few people. Now, certainly in England, a kind of Anglican kind of fantasy that we hold on to is the idea that the priest must at all times be equally available to everybody. And we know it's a fantasy because, you know, right now I'm speaking to you. Therefore, I am unavailable to the whole of my diocese at the moment. There may be some terrible problems kicking off somewhere, but it's too bad. It's going to take a really big emergency to take me away from my commitment to speaking to you this afternoon. So I'm unavailable. So the question is, who are the few people to whom God is asking you to give disproportionate time? And rather than think, how can I plant a fresh expression of worship in my church? That may be way down the line. Ask yourself, if I'm in a church where I feel burdened by that which I've inherited and can't see ways of breathing fresh life into it, I would say, well, don't try to breathe fresh life into it. Just love it and sustain it as best you can and let God worry about the rest. And then say, who are those two or three people that God has put in my congregation through whom something very beautiful and very different might emerge were I to give them some disproportionate time? And that's how, that's a kind of new monastic model that you actually form within your church, a cell of people who want to be church differently and see where that takes you. Yeah, thank you. I mean, the danger of me saying this to you from the other side of the world is I'm going to sound like I know what I'm talking about, and I don't. I mean, I'm sharing with you some ideas. All I could say to you is, all these ideas have come from things I've either been involved with myself or things I've seen happen. But there is not a blueprint. There is not an off-the-shelf answer. I think all I would say to you is, with regard to the giving disproportionate amount of time to a few people, is those few people will probably have to take up dual citizenship to begin with. You're not actually asking them to leave one service in order to start another. But what you are doing is working with the grain of what God has given you to say, well, actually, because it was in response to the specific question that I think it was Margaret asked about, you know, what do you do when the church you've inherited and the worship you've inherited doesn't kind of want to change and move? And that can be soul destroying for many priests who themselves have a vision of how the church might be different, but feel completely powerless to do much except tinker with what they've inherited. And it comes home to me, and I've heard many priests say this, and it's such a tragedy. I've heard priests say, if I was a layperson in my parish, I wouldn't worship there. Now, that's terrible. I understand it, but it's terrible. And therefore, I think there's a real urgent requirement for us to say, well, if we wouldn't worship in our own churches, Let us begin to dream and imagine some worship that we might want to be part of. Let's find two or three people to work with to begin to make that happen. It may be 10 years away before it actually bears fruit. And in the meantime, you're going to be asking those two or three people, because they're bound to be key members of your community, you're going to ask them to, as I say, take up dual citizenship. They'll still be coming to your main Sunday service, but also maybe meeting for something else. To begin with, it might only be once a month. But I think, and I see it all around, the evidence is that when churches do pioneer something new, it can be a rich blessing to their life. Yeah. Yes. What an interesting question. I mean, certainly if you read the Gospels, you would probably draw the conclusion that we should have an open table and a closed font. I think I could see why you would draw that conclusion. However, the feeding stories in the Gospels, as I understand it, are that they foreshadow the Eucharist, but they are not the Eucharist of the Church. So I think I'm probably much more persuaded by the passages in Paul about eating and drinking appropriately when it comes to inviting people to receive the sacrament. So I hold to a fairly traditional line on that. I've never been to St. Gregory's in San Francisco, which some of you will be aware of. I would love to go there, and it's exciting to think about the way that they have changed the whole pattern of the church building to emphasize the open table and the closed font. But what I believe about the Eucharist is such that the Eucharist is the sacrament of our belonging, and our belonging flows from our baptism. And therefore, although I would never and have never refused anybody communion, certainly as a parish priest, I always made the point of inviting any Christian of any denomination to come and receive the sacrament, but also saying briefly that our receiving the sacrament is part of our belonging to Christ. And although we extend the invitation for all to come and know and receive Christ, if that's not where you are on your journey, then you may prefer just to come and receive a blessing. So it sounds like, probably as I'm talking, it sounds like a good Anglican compromise. I don't actually tell people they can't come, but I'm not sure the open table is the answer. And the other reason I say that is in my dealings with young people, I think many young people look at the church, and what gets them about the church is that we don't ask for enough commitment. It's like we roll over too easily. And I think participation in the Eucharist as a sign of our belonging to Christ and our responding to Christ does not mean that if you are not yet at that stage of your journey, you should feel excluded. On the contrary, it can just be the challenge you need to say, well, where do I stand on all this? So I don't think the open table is the answer. Yeah, I guess in the UK, many of our fresh expressions are led by the clergy still, although there are lots of lay pioneer ministers and lay people clearly involved in the leadership, but it would still normally be the case that a priest is involved. For me, if one thinks of the Catholic fresh expressions as being as much about fresh expressions of the religious life as fresh expressions of, if I could call it, you know, congregational Sunday morning church, of course, actually, whether it's a priest leading it starts to matter less and less. St. Francis was a deacon, wasn't he? But he was never ordained as a priest. And many of the great pioneers of the religious life were lay people, obviously leading a consecrated life, but it was lay people. So I'm rather encouraged by looking back into the history of our own tradition and seeing that there are models of lay-led communities. Now, Of course, for us, they would also need to be sacramental communities, so there must be a priest involved, but the priest doesn't necessarily need to be the leader. Let me tell you another little story of a community I was involved with a couple of years ago, which was a small lay-led community of Christians living together under a rule of life, committed to... Well, they called... I think this movement is going to spread all around the world. They call themselves the kind of 24/7 prayer movement. And as the name suggests, their commitment is to pray 24 hours, 7 days a week. And it's mainly young people, again, mainly coming from an evangelical tradition, but really exploring the Catholic tradition, completely lay-led, and a community committed to the rule of life, which was about prayer. One of the leaders of this community, a very impressive young man, came to see me because he thought that God might be calling him to the priesthood, and he couldn't work it out. He didn't really have much of a theology of the priesthood, and he couldn't quite work out his call. Where we got to in some fascinating discussions about that was turning the question on its head. Not so much, why has God called you to be a priest? Rather a kind of individualistic approach. The question became, why does God want your community to be a sacramental community? Because if one of you is ordained as a priest, that will change the nature of your community life. And once we realise that may be the discernment, not why is God calling me to be a priest, but why is God calling our community to be a sacramental one? He's about to be ordained, actually, this year, that young man. It all became clear for him, and he pursued ordination. And I think what I see there is a sign of a community that will remain a lay-led community, but it will now be a lay-led community of whom one of their number is a priest. And therefore that community will now evolve to be much more of a sacramental community while still being committed to prayer, but the main leadership will still be lay. So it may be that this is causing us to re-examine our understanding of priesthood, and I think also it will cause us to re-examine our understanding of episcopacy. Because what all these communities and fresh expressions do need is oversight, but the oversight might be provided by a new episcopacy, and the priesthood might become re-expressed. In Anglicanism, being a vicar has always meant being the leader of the community. Well, perhaps some of the fresh expressions are asking us to see priesthood in another way, which, again, there's plenty of precedents from church history. And I find that a really interesting and encouraging development, not least for those priests who have said for years anyway that they didn't feel God was calling them to be a leader. He was calling them to be a priest. And we, the Anglican Church, say, well, that's too bad. You've got to lead this community. Well, the fresh expressions are actually offering different models, which are quite consonant with Catholic tradition. I'd be glad. I mean, I think another idea that it might be good to have in our head is of, I mean, having said all this, perhaps I should have said this at the beginning, I don't much like the phrase fresh expressions. I mean, we're kind of lumbered with it, but it already feels rather tired to me. And of course, there's nothing fresh about fresh expressions. Every church, there isn't time now, but if you break for a cup of coffee in a minute, just ask yourselves the question, when did the church that I'm a part of begin? I mean, every church you're a part of, you'll have a patronal festival each year, and that patronal festival will celebrate not just your patron, but also your history. There was a time when your church didn't exist, and then somebody planted it, built it, established it. And the reason they planted it, built it, established it was for reasons of mission. It might have been, expansion of the town. It might have been population growth. Who knows what it was? But, if you go back into your own history, your church exists for a reason, and that reason is almost certainly missional. So it's just wise, first of all, to remember that. Every church community had a beginning. And that beginning was born out of a missionary imperative that we need to establish the life of the church in this community. So what we're thinking about in so-called fresh expressions is nothing new. It's simply saying, because of the missionary situation we now find ourselves in, should we be finding new ways of giving birth to Christian community? And it's Christian community that matters. So then if you think of it as a spectrum, and at one end of the spectrum, it might be a new building in a new neighbourhood where there's a new population centre and where there's no Christian presence. That would be planting a whole new church community. That's one end of the spectrum. But let me take you right down the other end of the spectrum to some very simple things that can have a big impact. And again, this is a story from my own experience. When I was a parish priest, we had a mass every day. I mean, that was the sort of church I was part of. It was a daily mass church. Most of the masses had a handful of people coming to them each day. But the Wednesday morning mass had about 12 people coming. And the 12 people who came pretty much every Wednesday, 10 o'clock on a Wednesday morning, was a mixture of elderly people who also came on Sunday. And so it was a kind of devotional thing for them to come to another mass during the week. And then we had two or three young mums for whom Sunday morning had become a battleground, either because their husband didn't go to church and therefore it was a cause of tension that the wife did want to go to church, or also with the children. And I'm sure it must be the same in Canada, but certainly in Europe, certainly in the UK over the last 20 years, Sunday has changed out of all recognition. Shops are open on Sunday, people go to work on a Sunday, there's all sorts of leisure activities happening on a Sunday. I speak, you know, as the father of teenage children who want to do things on Sundays. And so church can very quickly become a battleground about do we go or don't we go, and in order to go, what am I having to give up? And so I found on this Wednesday morning mass that these two or three mums came and they never came on Sunday. So in other words, Wednesday morning was church for them. How did I respond to this? Well, I'm ashamed to say that I responded at first by trying to persuade these mums that they really ought to come on Sunday. Why ought they to come on Sunday? Well, Sunday is proper church. That is the main gathering of the people of God in that community, and you ought to be part of it. These daily celebrations of the Eucharist are kind of devotional extras, but they're not supposed to be the main diet. So that was kind of my agenda. I sat lightly to it because I understood why they didn't come. But if I'm honest, that's what I thought they ought to do. They ought to be coming on Sunday, and they really ought to be trying to, you know, persuade their husbands to at the very least let them come or bring them along as well. So anyway, that's how I was approaching it. But then the penny dropped. And it suddenly dawned on me that instead of fighting a rear guard action to keep Sunday special, what was actually happening was that the Holy Spirit, as ever, was a few steps ahead of me, and the Holy Spirit had danced on ahead of me and was blessing Wednesday. Because even though I thought people ought to be coming on Sunday, Wednesday started growing. And what started off as two or three young mums, suddenly over the course of a year or two, became four or five young mums. Because these young mums who enjoyed coming on Wednesday morning were, in an authentic, natural way, evangelising, they wouldn't have used the word, but they were evangelising their network of mums to say, you know, we go along on Wednesday morning, why don't you join us? So now, after being there a couple of years, I inherited a congregation of, let's say, about 10. Now it's still only got up to about 15 or 16, but it's noticeably bigger. When the penny dropped and I realised that God was blessing Wednesdays, my whole attitude to Wednesdays changed. And it was a very simple change, but it had a big impact. Once I realised that for that group of people, Wednesday morning was church for them, I started doing it and approaching it differently. What I mean by that was, it was a said Eucharist. I, by the way, I'm somebody who always preaches, or virtually always preaches. So I'd always given a short homily at that Eucharist. Now I started putting a bit more work into that homily. We started having coffee and tea after the service. I didn't want to make the service too much longer, because part of the attraction of it was that it was only about half an hour, 40 minutes, but we did start singing, just one or two chants or songs within the liturgy. And then once a month, I invited people to stay behind after the Eucharist for a kind of, what I would call a nurture group, a kind of home group, Bible study, nurture session, so that we could grow in our faith and begin to think about how it impacted the whole of our lives. Well, by the time that I left that church, we were regularly getting over 30 people on a Wednesday morning, and getting on for half of them never, ever came on Sunday. This was before the jargon fresh expression had been coined. But what I'd effectively done was planted a new congregation with its own distinctive liturgical life, its own distinctive nurturing of its life by the once a month kind of home groupy thing that happened afterwards. It was a fresh expression of church, but it was a fresh expression of church at the kind of most modest end of the spectrum. And so the other conclusion I draw from that is, are there in many of our churches things that we are already doing which have the potential and capacity to do more? Particularly, as one of the reasons we've, you know, these fresh expressions have happened at all, particularly because we are living in a rapidly changing culture. And certainly for us in England, the nature of Sunday has changed beyond all recognition in the space of about 20 years. So Sunday is just not an option for many, many people, because they go to work, you know, even if they've decided to, you know, not join in the whole kind of leisure thing. Many of them work on a Sunday, so they could never come to church. One last thing on the Wednesday morning experience. Fascinated by this experience, I then started looking around to see what other churches were doing. And about 10 years ago, I suppose it was now, I, with a colleague of mine, we did some research. We did a research across a deanery of churches in West Yorkshire, 17 churches in that deanery, and we got the church wardens to take a register in every church over a two-month period. And the reason we had to be a register, it was quite hard work to get this done, but we did achieve it with an almost 90% return, so statistically very significant. We wanted to try to plot the pattern of people's church going. And what we found from this research, one, we were staggered by how few people came every week. A tiny, tiny proportion actually came every week, even though the clergy did think. They said, oh, we've got a small group of people who come every week. Well, it was a lot, lot smaller than they realised. The other two things which staggered us was, one, the huge number of people who came once. Much more than we expected. People who just appeared once. We don't know why, but they just did. But the other thing we found was that every single church, without exception, which had weekday Eucharists or a weekday service, had people attending that service who never, ever came on Sunday. Now, I think that's hugely significant, particularly for churches of a Catholic tradition, where we tend to be churches which have always had weekday Eucharists of one sort or another. So instead of actually thinking, how do I start a fresh expression, it might be a matter of, how do I think differently about what's happening on a Tuesday evening or a Wednesday lunchtime? Or if I don't have services like that, how might planting something very simple like that actually provide the opportunity for people who are disenfranchised by the church which only exists on Sunday? So that, I call that the most modest end of the fresh expression spectrum. But I've been hugely saddened in England that, although, you know, I've banged on about this ever such a lot, and so have other people, there are still many, many churches which still only ever have services on Sundays. Well, I kind of still think they might. Yeah, I mean, I don't quite buy the thesis which says you know, our world is so strange and so alien that people are never going to walk through it. I just don't buy that. I've had too many experiences of people who have. I mean, my own experience. I mean, I wasn't, as it happens, I wasn't brought up going to church myself. So my own story is one of encountering, you know, the church in all its kind of full-blooded Catholic weirdness from a standing start. So I just don't buy it that it's completely off-putting. Going back to my first story, I do think we need to re-inhabit and reimagine our own traditions, but I don't mean to make them kind of user-friendly particularly, so much as to actually, you know, address that question we were thinking about earlier about I wouldn't even go myself. You know, if we're not inspired, motivated, elated by our worship, well, little wonder nobody else is. So we need to breathe some fresh life into our traditions. But I don't think that so-called unchurched and so-called de-churched people are never going to engage with it. But, as I also said near the beginning, alongside all our talk of liturgy and worship, we must also be paying very, very close attention to the life and impact of the church within the community, because it will be the evidence of our Christ-like lives lived in service and blessing to our communities. That is what will make the difference. And when people glimpse Christ in us, they will be drawn towards the worship of the church. So I simply believe that to be the case. So I understand why people say all that, but on the whole, they say it from a very different liturgical and theological tradition. And I think it's quite okay for us from a Catholic tradition to say, well, you know, we part company now. That's not how we see it. Yes, well, thank you. A very unsatisfactory answer, because I think the answer is both, and the answer probably is what's going to be authentic to who you are as a community of faith. I think I'm much more drawn towards the model of the first question is how are we a blessing to our community? As I've said several times now, that for me seems to me to be the first question. Out of that, a new worshipping community may emerge. So I think I'm much more drawn to that model of understanding. Damien Feeney is a good friend of mine, and I have been to the Eucharist in Asda, and it's received great publicity all round the world. And I don't mean to kind of, you know, burst the bubble, but I don't believe at all that was the answer. It was a very fascinating thing, and I'm really glad I went to it. But on the whole, it was an act of interesting witness to Asda. It was not drawing people into it. You know, it was like the Christian community up sticks, went down to Asda, did its thing in the foyer while the world went by. Now, that's a good thing to do. And of course, people did engage with it, not least because, you know, you could not engage with it at some level. But the idea that lots of people came to faith and it grew as a community, I mean, that is, I think, you know, that is not what happened. And I think people who were, you know, Damien himself would not make those claims for it. So I think the long-term work of building relationships and building community, there's no way of shortcutting that. I think the difference from a Catholic point of view is actually the confidence that, well, if what we believe about the sacraments is true, if it is true that Christ himself is present in the breaking of the bread, if that is true, then we should have the confidence to believe that sharing our worship and our prayer with people will be converting. And so I think it's that point of saying that for us, worship won't be this distant end point. It might be that much, much earlier in the journey, we'll be wanting both to pray with people and invite people to share with us in the liturgy and the sacramental life. So it's both. But I think on balance, my own experience is much more to do with that incarnational model, which I'm sure Steve Croft has... I've forgotten he was out there. Of course, he's with you, isn't he? Do give him my best wishes that he will have been describing so well. No, I think I'm sure I've said far too much. I think the last thing I would want to say is what worries me about the Fresh Expressions movement in England is that sometimes we have forgotten the need for there to be a ministry of evangelism that's part of it. I find it odd in a way that a movement that's so led by evangelicals needs an Anglo-Catholic bishop to say, don't forget about evangelism. But I think it is easy to forget it. And therefore, the things which I think are absolutely essential is, one, what I would call a place of nurture, somewhere where those who are beginning to ask questions and explore the Christian faith can come and find out more. I think it's absolutely vital for any flourishing church community, a place of nurture. And my last word would be, the best evangelism of all is the Christ-like witness of ordinary Christian people in their ordinary daily lives. That's what I long for. And I know this may sound a bit strange to say at the end of a seminar about Fresh Expressions. You know, forget about Fresh Expressions, forget about church planting, forget about church growth. What matters is holiness of life. And when we lead lives which are translucent of the gospel, you know, when Christ is seen in us, when we are a people of prayer, well, Brother Roger of Teze says, when the church becomes a house of prayer, people will come running. Now, I have glimpsed that to be true. I have glimpsed lives being changed, Christ being visible and evident in people's lives, and that having dramatic impact on others. And that's what matters. So I would say to Christians of all traditions, but especially Catholic Christians, let's have much, much greater confidence in the things that God has given us, in the ability of the sacraments to change our lives, to turn us around, in the pursuit of holiness, in being people of prayer. And if we pay attention to all of that, then I think our churches will flourish. And what always worries me is a kind of, we can be an idolatrous church, and Fresh Expressions can just be the latest bandwagon that we jump on. I think it's got some really, really important insights to make, but let's not forget the pursuit of holiness and that the gospel imperative to share with others what we've received. That's much, much more important. Yeah, thank you. God bless you. Thank you.